Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Kendall, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally, in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's first campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is Who Will Be Our Privacy Champion? Congress, the FTC, or Class Action Lawyers? I will be introducing Randy Dreyer, who will be introducing our speaker. Mr. Dreyer works at the University of Utah as a professor, and he is jointly appointed to the law school and the Honors College. Most importantly, he is a former Hinckley intern. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Dreyer.
Well, thank you. We are very fortunate to have one of the country's foremost commentators on privacy issues here at the university this past week as the Honors College Scholar in Residence, Kashmir Hill, who is the senior online editor at Forbes. She is a Duke University graduate and has her master's in journalism from NYU. Prior to working at Forbes, she was an editor at Above the Law, which is a legal blog. Every lawyer likes to follow that because it does have a little bit of a gossip aspect to it, and we all like gossip, right? All right, so Kashmir writes a blog called The Not-So-Private Parts, and she takes very complex legal issues and other issues regarding privacy and writes about them in a very approachable, easily to understand way. She also writes her own headlines for her blog, and so I thought I would just give you a little flavor of some of the types of writings that she does by reading the headlines for some of her more popular posts. For example, she wrote a story about titled, "Another TSA Officer Leaves Personalized Note in Passenger's Bag After Finding Marijuana." About 300,000 page views on that. 10 incredibly simple things you should be doing to protect your privacy. Again, about 300,000 page views. Beware tech abandoners. People without Facebook accounts are suspicious. Had about over 500,000 page views of that particular column. Oops, Mark Zuckerberg's sister has a private Facebook photo go public. Almost 1 million page views. And then her most popular post, at least to date, with almost 2 million page views, was an article titled, "How Target Figured Out a Teen Girl Was Pregnant Before Her Father Did." So let's welcome Kashmir Hill.
Thanks, Randy. So I have some prepared remarks, and then I'm hoping we can talk a little bit, and if there are things in this topic or about privacy or about privacy legislation or regulation that you'd like to talk about, that we can get into that. But let me just get started. So the U.S. Doesn't have a Department of Privacy. Unlike many countries, we don't have a privacy commissioner. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia has said there is no right to privacy since it's not in the Constitution. So instead, our privacy is governed by a kind of patchwork quilt of laws and statutes. I don't know how familiar you are with them, but I just wanted to name a few. Some are kind of weirder and more specific than others. There's the Wiretap Act against eavesdropping on your phone communications. There's the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable searches and seizures. There's the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. This is what protects the privacy of your electronic communications, your email, your Facebook messages, your Twitter DMs. There are invasion of privacy torts. There are anti-stalking laws. There's the Children's Privacy Protection Act, which protects children from having information collected about them. There's the Video Privacy Protection Act, which ensures that no one will find out you rented the hot tub time machine. There's the Video Voyeurism Prevention Act. This was passed in 2004. It prohibits the filming of private parts when individuals have a reasonable expectation of privacy, even if they're in public, and it does make an exception for cleavage. That one was passed to kind of prevent upskirt filming in public places. So, you know, there are a lot of different parts of privacy in terms of protecting it, and I think part of the reason for that is because privacy is so big. It's kind of a hard concept to define. There's a whole branch of academic scholarship devoted to trying to pin down its meaning. Is it the right to be left alone? Is it the right to control facts about you? Is it the right to have information you provided in one context not used in a different context that you didn't expect? Is it the right to, you know, go to the airport and not be patted down or have to put your arms in the air and spread your legs before you get on an airplane? Or have an x-ray image made of your body before you can get on an airplane? The added challenge in terms of looking at privacy is the way that technology is rapidly evolving and really changing the way that information can be gathered about us, the way it can be stored, the way it can be analyzed to figure out new things about us. The Supreme Court has had the incredible challenge over the last few years, last decade really, of figuring out how to apply a document written in 1789 to smartphones, GPS trackers, thermoimaging devices, and DNA databases. On Tuesday, the Supreme Court justices were debating whether the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable searches should prevent law enforcement from building genetic databases of people who have never been convicted of crimes. So should the police need to get a warrant before they can take a genetic sample from someone who's simply been placed under arrest? Once they take that sample, they could compare it to tons of cold cases for a match, or they could keep it for a future match of a genetic sample found from a crime, or they could use it to identify a relative of that person who may have left genetic evidence at the scene of a crime, because your DNA is linked to that of your parents, your siblings, your grandparents, your children. This isn't just about your privacy, but the privacy of everyone related to you, even if they haven't even been born yet. The idea of being in a genetic database is kind of scary, yet I sent off a sample of my own saliva to a consumer genetics company called 23andMe years ago, so I'm already part of a genetic database. And I definitely read their privacy policy before I did that, but I doubt that many of their 200,000 customers did. How many of you guys read privacy policies before you sign up for a service? Not very many.
They're being honest.
Yeah, and you should. And you are. That is very typical. I'm not surprised by that at all. But that is your agreement with a company, and that's really what governs your privacy rights or lack thereof. So, yeah, it's a huge topic. I spent 4 years writing about it at the not so private parts, and sometimes I feel like I've just started to scratch the surface of the topic. Today I'm going to try to limit the scope of my remarks to consumer privacy issues, so talking about your privacy from companies and by companies rather than talking about government intrusions into your privacy, though I'm happy to get into that if that's what you're more interested in during the Q&A. So the topic today is who will be our privacy champion, Congress, the FTC, or class action lawyers. I describe myself as a pragmatist, and I tend to leave the idealism to like the think tanks and the activists. So I'm going to try to tell you about the lay of the land today rather than how I think it should be. As of somebody didn't listen to that phone warning. As of 2013, I'm living in San Francisco, but for the last decade, I spent 7 years altogether in D.C., and for the last 2 years, I was there as a reporter covering privacy. And honestly, I'm a bit disheartened by the legislative process, so I don't think I'm necessarily going to be holding up Congress as the champion of our privacy. The last really big privacy law to be passed was the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. That's what I was telling you about that governs privacy of your email and your Twitter DMs and these kinds of communications. And it's pretty old now, 1986. I don't think most of you were born at that point. So it was passed before you were born. And at the time it was passed, email worked really differently. You had, when I sent an email to you, it would go from my computer, it would be up in the cloud, and then you would turn on your computer and you would download it from the cloud, and then it would be on your computer. And that was how email worked. But as you know now, today, everyone has their email just stored up in the cloud all the time. But when the law was written, they assumed that any email that was in that cloud after 180 days was basically abandoned. Like, you were never going to download it. It was basically trash. And so it loses its privacy protections. And law enforcement doesn't need a warrant to look at email that's up there. But that means that's the case for all of your email now. And it's just kind of an outdated concept that was part of this law because of the technology at the time. And we haven't updated it. And Congress knows that this is a problem. It's aware. Privacy advocates talk about it all the time. The courts have fixed it a little bit, but it's still an issue. And it seems like it would be a pretty easy one to fix. So people got pretty excited this year when Senator Leahy attached a fix to a different privacy law that was getting debated, the Video Privacy Protection Act. Netflix and Facebook wanted this act to be updated. This is an act that was passed after a Supreme Court nominee, Robert Bork, had his video rental records published by a newspaper. Somebody from the Washington City paper just went to, Potomac Video Rental and said, hey, you know, this guy is a public figure. Everyone's really interested in him. Can you tell us the movies that he's watched? And the clerk was like, yeah, sure, here you go. And lawmakers got really upset about this. And so they passed a whole law just to protect what you rented from video stores. So fast forward to today, Netflix is worried that they can't do frictionless sharing with Facebook and tell everyone the movies you're watching. They're afraid they would get in trouble under this law. So they asked Congress if they could update it so that, you know, people can give one-time permission to share all of their video rentals. And so Congress decided to help them out with this. Leahy added an amendment that would fix this 180 days thing. So everyone was all excited that it was going to pass, and then the Video Privacy Protection Act amendment passed, and they stripped the ECPA apart. So we had just lost some privacy instead of gaining some. And so it's things like that have made me a little skeptical that Congress is really going to get a privacy bill through. So usually what I focus on more in my reporting are they usually call it the three legs of the stool of consumer privacy protection. One is attorneys general, who are kind of increasingly thinking of themselves as the internet police, and they will go after companies over certain internet issues. One of the famous ones is an attorney general who went after Craigslist for having the erotic encounters section of the website, which was basically a place where you could put prostitution ads or prostitution solicitation. So they got Craigslist to get rid of that section, and now all those people just post instead in Craigslist casual encounters. And then you have class action lawyers who pursue lawsuits against companies when they screw up, and it's been interesting to watch these guys because privacy class actions have started to be quite lucrative, and so there are a lot of these suits against companies for, you know, putting cookies on people's computers when they're not supposed to. Google Buzz, when Google Buzz exposed, I don't know if you guys were around when this was happening, it was a couple years ago, Google started this new social network called Buzz, and they, in order to get people excited about it, they auto-populated their friends list, and the way they did that is that they looked at who they emailed most often. Said, oh, here are all your friends. Here are the people that you care about the most, and we know that because you email them all the time. And they made that public, and so they essentially took private information and made it public. And for some people, you know, this was like rather revealing, and people were really very, very upset about it. And in some cases, it could lead to harm. So like one woman who has a stalker, her ex-husband. She said, you know, he was able to see like all of my closest contacts, and now I'm worried about them. And so class action lawyers went after them for that. And class action lawsuits have done a lot of good. They've like eliminated flash cookies, which were cookies that could go on your computer to reveal information about you that even when you cleared cookies from your computer, they would stay there. So there was a big lawsuit against them for that, and they're not allowed to do that anymore. There was one against Netflix for even when you close down your account, they would like hold on to your rental records for a really long time, and that was technically a violation. Facebook sponsored stories. I don't know if you guys know about this, but on Facebook, if you like something, you can end up in an ad saying that, you know, if I like Starbucks, I can be in an ad that's like, Cashmere likes Starbucks, you for all my friends. Like, you should go and buy a latte from them. And so there was a class action suit over the last 2 years, and they said that this was a violation of our right of publicity and the right to control endorsements that use our name and photo. And they ended up settling that lawsuit with Facebook. It's still in negotiation. I think it's going to be a $20 million settlement. And all of you, as a result, are going to have more control over which ads you appear in Facebook. And you should be able to tell Facebook, no, I don't want to be in an ad around this like. So you should get more control. But a lot of class action lawyers, like, recognizing that it's a good opportunity, some of them, when you look at the history of their firms, they're now kind of privacy and technology experts. But 10 years before that, they were doing personal injury cases. So it's essentially like ambulance chasers that are now like privacy violation chasers. So some people think that they could kind of hurt, that they hurt the cause a bit by going after companies a little too early, that they are kind of stretching the law in some cases in order to try to prove that there was a privacy violation when it was actually something that was rather small. I think that they have done a lot more good than harm and have resulted in some changes that have helped protect all of your privacy. But the class action lawyers also, like, have just made a lot of money for themselves. And then the third leg, which I kind of want to focus on, is the Federal Trade Commission, or the FTC, which is an agency who is supposed to enforce, it protects you from companies' unfair and deceptive trade practices. And the FTC has really, like, stretched this out into a way to really enforce your privacy. Even though FTC doesn't particularly have jurisdiction over privacy rights, it's essentially like pulled privacy rights into this idea of treating you unfairly or treating you deceptively, and then maybe revealing, like Google did, public and private information about you publicly. I think it's been very effective, though there was an article by a journalist for ProPublica. His name's Peter Moss, and it appeared in Wired. And it was really quite quite critical of the FTC. He described it as a low-tech, defenseless, toothless privacy watchdog. And he started off his piece by criticizing the FTC for not being the first one to discover that Google was circumventing Safari privacy protections on Apple iPhones. It was placing a cookie on your smartphone, even though it wasn't supposed to be doing that. And it was because Google wanted Google Plus to work on people's phones the way it wanted it to, and Apple's privacy protections were interfering with that. So they just went ahead and put the cookie on there anyways. And this was discovered by Moss described him as a sleep-deprived Stanford grad student named Jonathan Meyer. And so Moss was saying, you know, there are all these, like, privacy violations happening, and the FTC isn't discovering them. And that's because it doesn't have good technology. They basically, the FTC has like a mobile forensic lab where it tests smartphone apps for data leakage and pilfering. And it has an internet testing lab for going around on different websites and seeing what information they're collecting about you and whether they're complying with their privacy policies. And he said it looked like a computer room in a public library or middle school. He argues they're underfunded, understaffed, and behind the times technologically. So this agency, which is really probably the most important one in terms of protecting your privacy right now, has about 50 people in its privacy division, and 20 lawyers. Of those 50, it's 20 lawyers working on privacy cases, and it's overseeing, you know, kind of a vast. I mean, there are so many different companies that are involved in the privacy or personal information. Just for one, the data mining industry now employs more than 100,000 people and has revenues of close to $5 billion, and that's just kind of one industry that this team of 50 is overseeing. The FTC, so when they look at what they've accomplished in privacy in the last few years, they say they've brought, you know, 39 cases on data security breaches, 19 cases around the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, more than 100 cases involving spam and spyware, dozens of cases alleging violations of the Do Not Call registry, and dozens more involving unfair and deceptive privacy practices, including cases against Google, Facebook, and Twitter. One of the really important ones, I thought, in the last year was against rent-to-own companies that leased laptops to people. And they would put spyware on the laptops so that if people stopped paying their bills, they could get the laptop back. And so the spyware will tell them, like, it has GPS on it so they can see where it is. It can take screenshots. And it can also activate the camera and take photos of people. So these rent-to-own companies would, sometimes when people didn't pay the bills and sometimes when the paperwork was just messed up and they thought people hadn't paid and they actually had, would turn on the cameras and start taking photos. And I think we have, our computers are kind of, I don't think you're thinking about your computer as a spying device. So you have it open in your house probably all the time. So they caught people, you know, just kind of sitting around, you know, watching TV. They caught people in their bedrooms, like walking around naked. They had photos of people having sex. And so it was really, really invasive. And people didn't even know that the spyware was on these computers. So that was a big settlement. That was a big case that the FTC brought. And the rent-to-own companies can't put the spyware on anymore or have to make sure that anybody who rents the computer knows that it's there. Personally, I have like a little sticker that I put over my computer camera when I'm not using it for a video chat or something like that, because it is a way to spy on you, and there are ways people can get access to that camera. So I would recommend that all of you think about getting a special little post-it note for your computers if you have that. Now, part of the challenge for the FTC is that U.S. doesn't really have one strong privacy law to enforce. The framework for privacy for them is based on a company's fulfilling their promises to you. And that's usually found in that privacy policy that you said most of you don't read. They say they're what they'll do with your data, and then they're supposed to honor that. And the FTC can only go after them if what they later do is deceptive or unfair, if what they told you they're going to do is not what they end up doing. The FTC has done some interesting things recently to try to like hack privacy law to make it stronger. Traditionally, unfair referred to you being charged like a different price than me for the same item, but the FTC has recently been stretching the definition of unfair to allow it more flexibility in enforcing privacy concerns, saying, for example, that it was unfair for a hotel chain not to better protect its customer's data from hackers, so when you were using like the hotel Wi-Fi. And it was unfair for a peer-to-peer file sharing network named FrostWire to publicly expose the files their users had downloaded. The FCC has also come up with a unique fix to give itself greater authority over monitoring the privacy practices of some of the companies whose names come up most often in the context of online privacy. So it has had recent settlements with Google and Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, which doesn't tend to come up as often anymore, but smartphone maker HTC over privacy scandals, and got them to agree to 20 years of privacy audits. So these companies now are beholden to the FTC to tell them every 2 years for 20 years what they're doing to protect their customers' privacy, what frameworks they have in place, what kind of information they're collecting, how they're using it. And so that is a way that they're essentially like forcing these companies to tell them about their privacy practices. Last year, the FTC hit Google with its largest fine ever, the largest FTC fine ever, $22.5 million for that cookie blocking feature, for circumventing the cookie blocking feature that Apple had built into iPhones. And they were able to do that because of the settlement that they had reached with Google. $22.5 million is a pretty big amount to you and me. To Google, that is an amount that they make in a day, probably in just a couple of hours. One case that's worth talking about is probably the Google Wi-Spy case. I don't know if you know about this. This is when Google had the Street View cars. Its Street View cars drive around when they're mapping and take photos and, you know, put them online so you can see what a building looks like before you get to it. But they had also put in Wi-Fi sniffing in their cars because they wanted to not only map houses, but they wanted to map Wi-Fi networks. And this is useful to them for all kinds of different things. But in addition to just like seeing that a Wi-Fi network was there, if it was unsecured, if you had an open Wi-Fi network, they were pulling data from it. And so they were pulling, they were seeing passwords, they were seeing parts of emails. They saw, you know, one email that was between like two people who are having an affair. They were pulling financial information, medical information, just basically like if you were on a website or whatever your internet activity was when their Street View car drove by. And they say they didn't realize this was happening, that an engineer like engineered this in and no one realized it. And it was only found out when a German privacy commissioner wanted to know exactly what the Google cars were collecting, and so started diving into their data, and then they found it. And so a lot of people have said, well, why didn't the FTC do something about that? And they said they didn't have a role to play because Google hadn't told consumers that it wouldn't do this. They didn't have an agreement with these people whose houses they were driving by. Google argued that it was just like equivalent to listening to the radio, that people were actually broadcasting this information publicly because they hadn't secured their networks. And so the FTC really couldn't do anything about it because it wasn't an unfair or deceptive practice. But this is where the class action lawyers come in. And, you know, they've sued Google. They say it is a violation of the Wiretap Act. That suit is ongoing, and I, you know, it's very possible Google will end up paying a big settlement for that one. And if nothing else, I think the important thing is that the Federal Trade Commission is paying attention to privacy issues. That puts companies on the alert, and they're not the only ones paying attention. Security researchers, tech journalists, and members of the public are just paying closer attention to privacy issues, I think, and how their personal data is being treated. And that public opinion does have an effect on companies' practices. And so a company like Google, when it gets this kind of anger from customers, is going to think more about how they treat personal information in the future and how they engineer their products to collect information or not to collect information. Of course, that requires, in order for, you know, public opinion or for the public to get riled up, they have to know what's happening, which isn't always possible when there's behind-the-scenes brokering of data that's being used to decide, you know, what offers you get, which offers you don't get, and whether you get to talk to a real person when you call a 1-800 number or if you get stuck hitting numbers for so long that you give up and hang up, because there, you are probably in a database somewhere where you've been given a score for whether you deserve to talk to a real person when you call a 1-800 number or not. So anyways, I hope that's helpful in kind of laying out the lay of the privacy land. I'd love to take your questions, hear your thoughts on this, dive into any particular area that you found interesting.
Okay, so for questions, just speak clearly into the mic, introduce yourself, and tell us just a little bit about yourself.
Oh, my name is Faisal. I'm a political science student. My question is the privacy acts that you have mentioned, how does it apply to on spying on people by drones, planes?
This is an interesting question. So this is an example of a technology that is new and novel, and we may end up passing new laws to address how drones are going to affect our privacy. There's been an act introduced in Congress and then around the country and in different states. People are starting to address, you know, whether police should need a warrant before they send a drone out to collect information about people. You know, how long that information should be kept, whether the drones can be weaponized or not. In terms of what it already exists, there is a law about there was a court case about a helicopter being flown over someone's house and whether you can, you know, gather that information. And I believe that the rule was basically at 400 feet, it's okay if it's if it's above 400 feet, that's considered okay because, like, anybody could fly over your house and look down. So that's not considered private at this point. I would say that probably some stalking laws would apply. So if you, like, had a drone that was following somebody for 7 days, you could say that that was the equivalent of stalking. There are more stringent. I was actually talking to a paparazzi agency when I was in California because I was wondering if they're going to buy drones and start using drones to track celebrities. And they said that the law is actually quite stringent in California. And so they'll use drones to fly over celebrities' houses to take photos of their houses. But California law doesn't allow them to take those photos if there's somebody, like, in the backyard. Then they're not allowed to use it. And, you know, that there are rules against them, laws against them using tracking devices. So they couldn't just have a drone, like, attach it to somebody using facial recognitions and have it follow them. But drones are going to introduce some new privacy questions. What I think about when I think about drones in the consumer context is, so Google already has Street View cars everywhere, right? Like, they're driving around, they're mapping everything. Well, when drones are legal for companies to use, which should happen in 2015, right now you're not allowed to use them commercially, like, will Google buy a bunch of drones and just start mapping the whole country? Just fly the drones, have it map buildings. You know, you might be on the 35th floor of a skyscraper and assume that you have privacy, but what if the drone just, like, comes up and, you know, starts taking photos of the buildings all the way up? Is there anything right now? I would say there's nothing in the law right now that prevents Google from doing that. So we'll have to answer that question. Like, is that something we want to be legal or not? With Street View cars, we decided that that was okay here in the U.S. In Europe, they were, they thought that that was more of an invasion of privacy to have people take pictures of your home and put them on the internet in a map. And in Germany, for example, Google had to give people the right to opt out and have their home blacked out on the Google Street View map. And here, that didn't happen. There was a lawsuit. A couple called the Borings in Pennsylvania didn't want to be in Google Street View. They said it was an invasion of their privacy for that photo that kind of shows the drive on their private property, their house. So they tried to challenge that and say that people should have the right here in the U.S. to opt out of being mapped by Google, and they lost that case.
My name is Sean Harris, and I'm a IS and political science major. And in addition to that, I'm also a systems administrator, so I have to deal with privacy quite often. And my
you get to see all the good stuff.
Oh, yeah. Delete email, you know, do it all. My question is a two-part question. Number one, with a group of people in Congress who feel that the internet is nothing but a series of tubes for content delivery, but they have no real understanding of how it works, do you think that it's realistic to think that there will ever be a nationwide privacy law? And part two would be, is it okay, how can the corporation blame the consumer, or how can the consumer blame the company for their inaction to secure their wireless network or protect their data first when Google is, you know, driving around listening to music, which just happens to be their Wi-Fi network?
Mm-hmm. Google would really like you on that jury when that case goes to trial. So with your first question, this is a problem. I mean, we have people in Congress who don't understand technology that well and are expected to make laws about it, not just about privacy, but about many aspects of technology, piracy, you know, hacking, cyber information sharing. So the hope is that they bring in really good security researchers and technologists. And in the couple of years that I lived in D.C., I'm starting to see many more people from the tech sector start to live there and start to advise Congress. So I do find that promising. I don't think you need to be tech savvy to understand privacy and to understand the implications of privacy and how information could be used against people. And some of the privacy laws that would be passed, like the Privacy Bill of Rights, is not a very tech savvy document. It's about, you know, having the right to get companies to delete data about you, having the right not to have information that you provide to a company then sold without your permission. And that's what happens right now. You know, like you get this free smartphone app and it starts collecting all this information about you, and then they go and sell that to other people. So you have a privacy policy that you haven't read, but at least you have an agreement with that first party, but then you don't have any kind of agreement with that third party. So that's part of what a privacy bill could address. So I think that the lack of tech savvy among some lawmakers doesn't mean that we couldn't get a privacy bill. It's more other concerns. It's, you know, industry lobbying against this because of the way it'll affect their business, or just fear of, you know, hampering innovation and the creation of new companies that comes from the free flow of information. With your second question, yeah, so this is what is going to be debated if this case ends up going to trial. I think people have generally moved away from having open Wi-Fi networks, but for a long time, not really. Okay, I guess in the areas that I live, most people have unfortunately closed them down. So it's harder to steal Wi-Fi. But yeah, if you have an open Wi-Fi network, and I don't know if a lot of people realize this. I hope you realize it when you're at Starbucks and, like, you're using an open network, that anyone else on that network who is savvy enough can see what you're doing. They can see what you're sending. They can see the searches that you're doing. They can see your web browsing. unless you're on a HT, and you probably don't pay attention to this, but HTTPS, if there's an S on the end, that means it's secured and encrypted. So Gmail, for example, has done this. They have like an encrypted web address so that when you're sending email, it can't be picked up this way. But almost about any other site you're using that doesn't have that protocol, people can see what you're doing. And this is a problem with kind of tech education. I don't think people realize this, and they don't realize that if they have an open Wi-Fi network, anybody can come and basically listen in, that you are in a way broadcasting to the people who know how to listen. And so that's what's going to be debated in this Google WiSpy case if it goes to trial. You know, people are doing this. They are broadcasting what they're doing, even though they don't realize it. So because technologically they're broadcasting it, does that mean the same thing as broadcasting it with informed consent? So is it an invasion of privacy? I'm trying to think of a good example. So if you're walking down the street and you're having a loud conversation with a friend about something very personal, and someone's behind you listening and gathering that information, is it an invasion of privacy for them to do that? That's like a kind of analogy that you could have. Even though you're having a private conversation, you're having it really loudly where they can overhear. That's what Google would say was essentially happening with the Wi-Fi networks. So it'll be interesting to see if it actually goes to trial, if they don't settle it. It always makes me very sad when the companies decide to settle it, and they usually do it privately, or with a non-disclosure agreement, so you can't even figure out like how much money exchanged hands, and it's very frustrating.
Hi, my name is Erica. I'm a sophomore here at the university, and I just wanted to know, what do you think is the biggest issue that we're facing when it comes to privacy?
This is so hard for me because there are so many. I think biometrics are a big issue. This is like face recognition and genetic databases. I've said this a lot, but I think that we are going to, like, facial recognition is getting better and better and better. So I can imagine in 5 or 10 years you'll have a smartphone app or a Google Glass app that you can use to identify anybody at any time. So you walk into a bar and you can know everyone who's there and any kind of like digital footprint that's attached to them or on the street. So I think there are going to be a lot of privacy issues around. I mean, Google has said they could already do this. They have a Google image search where you can take, like, I could take a photo of this portrait and then search for it online, and it would tell me, the title, who painted it, et cetera. Google says it can do that with faces already, but it's decided not to make that available because it thinks it's too creepy. So we're already there. They're just choosing not to release the technology. So I think that'll happen in 5 years. If genetic analysis gets better and better and cheaper and cheaper. Right now the police can use it to search a crime scene, but what if, like, we just all had devices? So, I can imagine, like, sibling wars where they can say, like, I know you were in my room because I use my DNA tester and I can tell you, like, touch my diary. So just the degree to which we'll be identified by these kind of biometric markers. The other big issue, I think, right now is data brokers. And there is this huge industry of data collection from you. You sometimes you know it's happening and sometimes you don't. So if you have a loyalty card that's tracking all of your shopping records, that's something that, I've had loyalty cards for like 10 or 15 years. So they know what I've been buying, like my grocery habits for 15 years, and that gets sold. And is used to profile me as, a granola eater or, an ice cream eater or a healthy eater or a junk food eater. And there's much, much more than that. Like, there's a lot about your browsing habits and, whether you visit running.com or whether you go to porn sites or whether you spend all your time on, I'm trying to think of, like, revealing websites that aren't necessarily medical information. But yeah, like if you're searching for ways to quit smoking, then they know you're a smoker. So all that information is kind of being gathered about you and starting to end up in databases, and it's used to advertise to you, which is like pretty innocuous, but also used to make decisions about you. And so what kind of regulation should there be over that industry and how they're using that data and how that data gets traded and whether you have any say over who it gets passed along to? I think that's a very, very big issue, and I don't think that we have a solution for it yet.
Hi, I'm Chris Rondom. I'm a philosophy major here at the U. I have a two-part question. They don't really coincide at all. I'm sorry. Okay. But what is your opinion on the German privacy group? I think it's a black bloc. I'm not sure. But they're calling for the removal of all monitoring cameras. And how, I guess, how does that affect the private citizens' crusade on monitoring systems? The second part is, when and how do you think we're going to make Tor available for everybody so we cannot be tracked?
Okay. So for the first question, yeah, I forget the name of that German group, but it's kind of a it's kind of like a real world almost game playing group where I think if we're talking about the same one, where players get points for the number of surveillance cameras that they take out. Is this the one that you're talking about? And it started in Berlin, and it's not just in Berlin anymore. There is now a chapter somewhere on the West Coast, I think maybe in Portland. So, yeah, so they're trying to take out surveillance cameras because they don't like this idea that you should be surveilled in public space all the time. And, you know, well, one, it's, like, illegal. It's destruction of private property. So I don't know if it works as a long-term solution to fighting public surveillance. Technologically, so there's already a camera used by the military. It's called the Gorgon Stare, and I don't know who comes up with the names for these things. Like, there's the Gorgon Stare. You know, the military has the Predator and the Reaper drones. Lockheed Martin makes a drone called the Stalker. I don't know why they don't call them Dan the Friendly Drone, and then people would like these technologies so much more. But the Gorgon Stare is this incredible camera that can be, I believe it's like, I forget how high up it can be, like 15,000 feet. And it can surveil just many, many, many square miles, like let's say 15 square miles. It's up in the air. It's a place where German activists would not be able to take this camera down. And it can see a person waving. It can make out their face. It can see like a small white bird flying. So if people just keep destroying cameras, then we'll put cameras in places where they can't get to them. And that is the way that technology works. It's that constant fight between coming up with a way to stop something from happening and then circumventing it. So, and cameras will just get smaller, and you won't be able to see them. You won't know where they are. I mean, the camera in your phone is so, so tiny. Right now, surveillance cameras are pretty big and bulky, and you can usually tell when they're around if you're looking. But eventually, they could just make cameras that are smaller than that. So I don't see that as a long-term solution or effective strategy. Your second question was about Tor. So anybody could use Tor right now. It's a little hard. So I think about this a lot because I write for a business magazine. I wonder about privacy businesses that will be successful. And right now, people, for as much as we care about privacy, we don't really care to pay for privacy. Most people, even knowing that that loyalty card is gathering lots of information about them, they still use it because they want to get like 50 cents off on their yogurt. And this happens a lot. We're not really... We prefer the free smartphone app that's going to collect a lot of information about us to the one that costs $2 that promises it won't. So I think a lot about whether we'll start caring about privacy enough that we would pay for it. And if that were the case, I could imagine a company that would essentially, you know, privacy-proof your computer for you and make it so you could, you know, browse anonymously so that you weren't leaking information when you went to websites. Set up your own email server so that Google can't look at the emails that you're sending. Or, you know, set you up with easy encryption so that you can send emails through Gmail, but only the person with the key on the other end can see it, and Google wouldn't be able to read it. So I can imagine that happening. It's just a matter of coming up with a business model and people that are willing to pay for it. Question?
Okay. My name's Stephen Doan. I'm a Spanish teaching major here at the U. I know that you've already said that Congress isn't, you don't really think that that's the hero of the future for privacy, but how long do you think it will take for whether the federal government or state government to pass a protection bill, including things like smartphone apps and I guess all this technology that we have nowadays, and what kind of things or privacy protections would you like to see in this bill?
So, the privacy is so big, it's hard to come up with, like, one bill that could address all of the problems. One thing that is starting to happen now is California requires that all smartphone apps have a privacy policy. And it's only in California state, but basically because most of the companies that are making it and almost any consumer that's downloading an app, you're probably going to have at least one customer in California. So it's basically a national bill. So in a way that establishes more privacy, only because – so that's the one thing that really, like, governs your privacy with that company. So at least – so even if you're not reading it, at least they've put it into words, which means that they can violate it, which means the FTC could go after them for violating it. So that's a good thing. There are some bills around – you know, the thing is they're, like, very specific. So Al Franken is very interested in privacy. It's like one of his big issues. And so one bill that he keeps trying to get introduced is about location privacy, specifically around smartphone apps and consumer data. And this would require smartphone apps to get explicit permission before collecting your location information, and that they would have to get explicit permission from you to pass it along to anybody else. And so that's there, that exists. You know, whether it's actually going to get passed is another matter. In terms of, like, one privacy bill to rule them all, I'd really like to see in writing, you know, what kind of control we should have over our information, and this kind of idea of whether you should explicitly need to give a company permission to pass it along to somebody else if it's not being used in, like, the regular course of business. So oftentimes your information gets passed along just because they have an email marketing firm that they use to send out their emails. Or there's a big scandal last year, the year before, with Carrier IQ, which was an app on your phone that could see everything you were doing. And people freaked out. They thought it was, like, spyware. But it was actually a program that the carriers were using because it helped them, like, decide to see, you know, who was getting bad, who didn't have good service, and deal with, like, network issues. But Carrier IQ had access to tons of information. And in that case, they were actually using it to help the business that you had a relationship with. But I would love to see a bill that deals with selling it to somebody you don't have a relationship with, who's offering you no services, who's just going to use that information in some way. They're just going to monetize the information in some way that could be harmful for you down the line. So I guess that's what I would like to see addressed.
Hi, my name is Rana. I'm a pre-med student. I have kind of a easy question. If I kill my Facebook account or Twitter account, do I need to erase everything, like posts and photos, or that's all? Or, I mean, my friends can see my posts even though I killed my account and the stuff.
I left. You say behind. Currently your friends can see your post even though you killed
the friends or the Facebook employees or anyone. I mean, if someone is out of the social network, mm-hmm. Does he need to erase everything before killing the account or?
Okay, I understand what you're asking. Yeah. So. So when you delete, for one, it's kind of like sometimes it's hard actually to delete the accounts. Facebook, I've talked to a couple of people here on this visit who said, yeah, I tried to delete my Facebook account, but they would only let me deactivate it, which means that they keep all of the information in their servers. Even though it's not visible on the site anymore, they still have it. And there is a way to delete it, but Facebook has actually, like, made it really hard to find it and to get to the page of deletion, which I think is, like, a little bit you know, not the way you should treat your customers, but regardless. So again, this is kind of like dictated by the privacy policy, which you want to read with any company. Like, when you delete your account, do they actually delete all of your information? With Facebook, they'll usually say, so if you can find that, like, mysterious page and that magical button to actually delete your whole account, it would delete your whole profile. It would probably delete posts that you've made around the site. But I'm not 100% sure. Facebook says, you know, they do their best to delete everything, but some things don't belong to you anymore. Like, if you've written on somebody else's wall, does that belong to you or does that belong to that person? You know, if you deleted your Gmail account, you could delete all of the emails that you have in your Gmail, but you can't delete all of the emails that you've ever sent to anybody. So this is about that kind of control of information thing. So with Facebook, I'm not sure where they stand on that, whether they see posts that you've written as information that they would have to delete. So in that case, I would say it'd be good to go. And Facebook has this nice tool now called an activity log, which will show you everything you've ever done on the network. So you could go back and like delete all of the posts that you've done. It'll also show you everything that you've searched on the network. So you can see your whole history of like all the people you've stalked. It's there and it'll show you, you know, you searched for this person over and over and over and over and over again. And it's kind of like a fun practice in self-awareness, and also it gives you a peek into what Facebook knows about you and what they collect, and why it is that they know you're more interested in some people than in other people, and what they put into your newsfeed. With Twitter, it's the same thing. Probably if somebody has retweeted you, and if they've retweeted you, then that post would probably stay up, so it wouldn't be possible to entirely delete your information that you've put out there already.
My name is Kevin Shaw, a sociology student. I'm just curious, like you say, like people like these privacy businesses, like that's kind of disgusting, like because that's something that you own, right? So is there like any, is there like a lot of groups you're aware of that are actually like lobbying hard in Congress, like to their congresspeople, like groups in the United States to just have it be an actual right here?
That we should have a right to privacy?
Yeah, like everything that...
But sometimes, yeah, I mean, the problem is sometimes you're not paying people to protect your information. Do you mean in the, like, would you apply this to Facebook? Do you mean?
Just like in general, like, just going back to your comment about privacy
business. Okay, privacy. So there aren't a lot of privacy businesses that are thriving right now that I would point to. There are some privacy businesses like, you know, you can get like special encrypted email services, or you can get a VPN, a virtual private network. So I get a VPN through Forbes. So when I get on the internet here, I get a warning before I connect to the guest wireless that everything I'm doing can be monitored and seen. So I use my VPN so that I have like a private encrypted channel that I can do my searching for through so that people can't see it. So if you... you know, had a VPN, if you were using that business to protect your information, and then the VPN, like, decided, to collect all of your web browsing and then sell it anyways, even though they promised you privacy protection, then they would get in a lot of trouble for that. So any business that gets into the business of protecting your private information is going to be held to a higher standard, and you could probably sue them and get money from them. They certainly would be liable for something like that. So I don't know if I'm exactly understanding your question, so maybe I'm not completely addressing it.
Like, if you have private information, it's like in your own space and sphere, like you shouldn't have to pay for people. It doesn't seem like to protect it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's interesting, Europe versus U.S. So there are certain things in Europe that you just can't do. You have to have permission to collect information about people. You have to have their explicit permission. So we've talked about – so there's the idea that you can have – so let's say Facebook, like, linked up with Kroger and decided to start having facial recognitions in Kroger so that, like, when you came in – you'd walk in and be like, "Hi, Kevin. You can have, you know, a 10-cent discount on popsicles." So they would like pick up on your face and like directly give you ads. I was talking about this from somebody with a European privacy lawyer, and he said, "Yeah, Kroger couldn't do that because they'd need to have explicit permission to use your biometric face print." But in the U.S., you could do that, and In the U.S., we kind of lean more towards, I would say, free flows of information and freedom of speech and freedom of action over the kind of like severe kind of privacy protection. It's hard to imagine us moving in that direction, moving in the European direction. I don't think Congress is being like lobbied hard by EPIC or EFF or CDT to create that. They are being lobbied very hard by industries that would hate that idea because it makes it really hard for them to come up with like new business approaches and new ways to monetize information. So no, I don't think that there's like a big push to move us in a direction of a kind of like really, really strong right to privacy. I just don't see that happening in the U.S. We do sometimes benefit from the kind of like side effects or the ripple effect from Europe. And that's happened a couple of times. So maybe that'll continue to happen where Europeans pushing back against American companies means that Americans end up getting a little bit more privacy.
Hi, thank you for coming, by the way, and taking the time to speak with us. I'm Stefan Sartain, sociology and political science up here. My question is more about kind of the future of society, whether you think we're going to be more apt to pick up on things like Tor with technology like Google Glass and that amazing camera from 15,000 feet, or whether you think we're going to give in and acknowledge that our privacy isn't really there, because we seem to be behind in legislation and educating people on how to protect their privacy. Do you think people are going to give in, or do you think we'll ever actually adapt to pick up on?
Yeah, so it's kind of a question about like how educated people are going to be and how the lengths they'll go to protect their privacy. I often like look at Facebook as, so Facebook has done a lot to erode our privacy, but I also feel like Facebook done a lot for privacy in that it makes everybody think about privacy in a way that they just didn't before, because they get affected by it every single day. Like somebody sees something they didn't expect them to see. Somebody posts something about them and tags them in it, and then all their friends see it, and they weren't expecting that, and they're upset that Facebook gave that person the right to do that. So I think, and the same thing with smartphones, that the GPS in smartphones and the way that smartphones can pass along information about us and reveal information about us has made people to start thinking about privacy a lot more. We're using these technologies daily that really have a huge effect on our privacy. So I feel like that people are more aware of it and thinking about it, and I think that's a great thing. In terms of savviness, yeah, I it's hard for me to. I'm always shocked. They'll do these surveys of people and ask them if they visited their Facebook privacy settings page, and a huge percentage of people never have. And it always shocks me because it's like this really kind of complicated but sometimes easy set of tools that you can use to protect your own privacy, and people just aren't even going there to do that. And so the idea of somebody going and learning how to use Tor or learning how to encrypt their email, I just don't see that really happening, even though they'll complain about the fact that their privacy is violated by these things. I don't see us – I think everyone is too busy. I don't know how cars work. I just get in my car and I turn the key and then it works and it drives me somewhere and I'm not thinking about how the engine works. And that's where a lot of privacy advocates say, yes, the government needs to address this and tell companies what they can and can't do, because people on an individual basis day to day don't have the space or the time to get educated about it and to do the things they need to do to protect their own privacy. So I think people are thinking about it a lot. I think they're angry about it and vocal about it, or apathetic about it if they just kind of have given up on privacy. But I think it's going to take like those really dedicated people to affect change and to make these tools easier to use so that anybody can kind of protect their privacy more easily.
All right, so that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me in thanking Ms. Kashmir Hill for an excellent forum.
Thank you.